Okay, so in a certain sense, this week's parsha is a little difficult, and the reason for that is because we sort of leave narrative and instead we move over to laws, and obviously laws are not as exciting or as interesting as narrative. So therefore, it's simply not as exciting. That's our problem. So that's the challenge. I mean, we will deal with the challenge and we will try to make it somewhat interesting anyway. But I really will spend almost all the time today dealing with the laws themselves. And what I'm looking for is actually what it is that the laws teach us. But I'll explain myself, much clearer in a moment. Just one more thing I wanted to say before we start, or as we start, and that is that that the shiur is going to be Le'iloi Nishmat Devir Ben Osnat. He was a little boy who was 2 years old, who passed away last week. They just got up from Shiva yesterday. And I'll say it because I think it's important. He passed away. He drowned in a pool which was covered, which means the rainwater which collected on top of the pool, which is not a lot of water, but a little 2-year-old climbed there and obviously fell, and he drowned in this. So it just says to what extent we need to walk around our houses and look and to see what is possibly dangerous, even in the most extreme possibility. And there's really a mitzvah aseh, according to some Rishonim, to go, just like there's an aseh to put up a ma'akeh, there's a mitzvah aseh, even if you don't do anything, just to take stock of your house and say, is there anything here which is dangerous? I mean, if you have something dangerous, then there's also a mitzvah to fix what's dangerous, which means that electrical wire which is sticking out, that you have to fix that. But I'm just saying is that this is frightening, because I don't know how many of us would clean up a little puddle from rainwater which is there. And unfortunately, but I went to visit the father who lives up the block over here, and I told him that I'll give the shiur today in his son's in Devir's memory. So Eloi Nishmato. So let us begin and get to our Parshat Mishpatim. And what you'll notice today is that we have here Ve'ela Mishpatim, and then I have on the right side these numbers, number 1 in yellow, number 7 in yellow, and number 6 in yellow, and 5 and 6 in yellow, and 8, and so on and so forth. So part of what you're going to do is you'll figure out what these yellows mean, but you don't have to worry that much, because I'll share and I'll explain. So it starts off Ve'ela Mishpatim, and I'm not going to get into the whole discussion of Ve'ela or Ela, the difference, continuation, new, whatever. There's something which I think is very obvious, at least it is to me, and I hope it is to you as well. And there are two parshiot in the Torah that when you start reading them, you get a sense that in some way, again, what that way is, that's a little harder because you have to then look for the nuance, but in some way, shape, or form, they are restatements or expansions or explanations, or have some kind of interesting relationship with the Aseret HaDibrot, with the Ten Commandments. What are the two parshiot? Well, one is very obvious, Mishpatim, and if you want, I'll even tell you what these numbers are. The hint is they're yellow, and they only go up from 1 to 10. So maybe that will help you to know what those mean. And the other parsha is Kedoshim. Also in parshiot Kedoshim, you also get this sense. But by Kedoshim, by the way, the Midrashim point these things out. It may not be as compelling there, but I believe that it is. I believe that you could certainly make the argument. And on the other hand, to compare Kedoshim and Mishpatim, there's also a little bit of correlation, but there's lots and lots of laws which are different between the two, and the emphasis, we can say, is different. But let's start with the beginning. Ve'ela mishpatim asher tesim lefneichem, we get Eved Ivri. So if you were to ask me, so what exactly does Eved Ivri have to do with the Aseret HaDibrot? And really what I'm doing is, I'm looking at the connection, but I'm going to be looking for something else as we move on, and I'm going to make that clearer. So this is very simple. I put a number 1 over there. Why is there a number 1? Because number 1 is, I'm God who took you out of slavery in Egypt. And maybe it even comes as a surprise. What in the world are we doing talking about slavery, of owning slaves, being involved in some kind of a slave trade or whatever it is, right after we were freed as slaves? Which means it could very easily be the conclusion that this is something which is really bad. Now, I know that some of you are very sophisticated, and you're going to tell me, no, this is not real slavery. This is instead of prison. By the way, all this is true. And instead of putting, I mean, what do we do with criminals? We put them in prison and they become better criminals. What is this doing? If somebody gets into some kind of financial problems or owes somebody money because they did something wrong, so now they get forced to sell themselves into slavery and they pay back the person who they owe. So therefore, in a situation of prison, it's possible that the victim will never get their money back. Over here, you end up working for the person. But on top of that, maybe there's something else which is important. Maybe you get to spend the time with the normative family instead of being put in a dysfunctional prison. In a dysfunctional prison with other prisoners who may be other criminals or maybe greater criminals than you. So maybe that's a bad idea. And instead you get to be put into a family, more of a family situation where the person has to treat you with respect. And there are all kinds of laws to the extent that some of us are familiar that the Gemara, especially the Rishalmi, says that when you end up getting a slave, you'll end up really having for yourself a boss because of all of the conditions. Now, all that everything I just now said is true, so I'm just going to say it again. It could have been that we should have been surprised that there's such a thing as servitude, but this really isn't classic servitude. But I do want you to note something else that I did over here. And that is I put two different numbers for the male slave, that I put number one, and then I put a different number for the female slave, number seven. So that should hopefully be interesting, because over here, then the reason I did it is a very simple reason, is that it sort of slips into marriage. When it came to the slave himself, the marriage issue was very, very different. Over here, it is so strong. I want to just point out maybe a couple of commentaries, but we'll read the words first. V'chim kar ish et bito la'ama, lo tetzet ketzet avadim. This is not the same as the slaves. Im rabi ne'odunah shelo ye'ada v'hefta. So what is this yi'ud? What is this ye'ada? It's a very important word. La'am nachri lo'im shelo machra bivigdoba. So what is this bigida which took place? And then it goes on. V'im levno ye'adena kimishpata bano ye'asela. So, and it adds, Sheirak suta vonata lo yigra. Make sure that the things that, so essentially, again, without getting overcomplicated yet, essentially this is saying this is a path towards marriage. How strong of a path it is, that's part of what we need to discuss at least a little bit. But first I want to point out the implications of this in terms of economics and social implications of this. Generally, the person who's going to be in a position to, quote-unquote, sell their daughter, and I do want to say quote-unquote, is going to be the kind of person who's has ran into serious financial problems, which means you're dealing with somebody who is toward the part of society that does not really have any kind of capital. And who's the kind of person who will make this kind of acquisition or purchase, as it were? That's going to be the person who does have capital. So then what happens? So now, very often, I don't want to say more often than not, maybe that's unfair, but more often than not, we all know the rich marry the rich and the poor marry the poor, and the rich, they have mergers and the poor have survival. And these are very different types of relationships. But what's interesting about this is you have a built-in law whereby somebody from a poorer family will end up marrying somebody who is wealthy. So what I'm about to say is subject to a machloket. According to at least some of the Tanayim, the money which was used as the quote-unquote purchase is the kesef kedushin, is the harayat mikudeshetli. This is the money, which means what is the yi'ud over here? The yi'ud is that, and now let's imagine she's somebody who is of marriageable age, more or less. We can also, again, I'm trying to avoid details as much as possible over here, but the purpose of all this is for a wedding to take place, but the bigida, and I'm going to come back to a moment because there's a bit of an argument, who exactly is guilty of this bigida, and we need a good word in English for bigida. But what the, again, at least according to some of the Tanayim, let me go back, let's say, for example, to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is one who says that the money that was given is the Kesef Kedushin. So if somebody else goes over to this girl and says, Hari at Mekudeshet li, and she accepts it, she's not married to that other person because there was already a, and now this is the question, what to call this. It is a kind of a quasi-wedding which is really being held in abeyance, which is going to be dependent upon the completion of this. But according to this opinion, the money already was exchanged. I'm going to say this again. There are really interesting social implications over here, because this then gives the ability of mixing up in terms of property and so on. I read a book very recently, which I'm supposed to write a book review for. And it's somebody that I know, somebody who's very well known in the Jewish community. His name is Howard Jonas. So this is not going to get me out of writing the book review when I say what I'm going to say. I was actually very struck by some very interesting observations that he had. One of the things that convinced him as a Jewish kid being brought up in a non-religious family about the brilliance and truth of Torah was the laws of Yovel. Because it wasn't pure socialism and it's not pure capitalism, and it's a way of wealth being distributed that even if somebody's on a really good run, okay, now that's going to go back to the person who lost their property, and we have this reset which is taking place. And he said simply that doesn't happen within society. Rich people collect things, and they collect more things, they collect more things. You never get this to push that reset button. And he found that as being something which was so fascinating. I'm going to say this again. He writes that the law of Yovel, where the properties return to the original owner, convinced him that it was a divine book. By the way, once you go there, there are other things to think along this way, but he was somebody who has a degree in economics from Harvard, and he knows economics, he knows how they work in different systems, and this just struck him as being so fascinating and being so different. So we can add, here's another example, again a microcosm of a similar kind of phenomenon, where somebody from a poor family ends up, because of the way the system is built, ends up then being married into the rich family. Now, I do want to go back into this idea of bivigdoba, what exactly is the bigida which takes place, and the commentaries are not unified on this. This we collected all the way towards the bottom over here. Rashi says, Imbalugdodba, Shaloli Kayemba Mitzvat Yiud. What's the Bigida? How do you want to translate Bigida? Who has a good word for Bigida?
Betrayal.
Betrayal. All of you have the same word. Okay. Betrayal. Excuse me, Mark? What do you say?
Treachery.
Treachery. Bigida, okay, good. Bigida over here. A betrayal would be, I think, the really good word to use. Betrayal. Okay. So look what Rashi said over here. Rashi said that if the husband, this person who acquired this girl, Imbalav Gdodba, if he betrays her, Shelo L'kayem ba mitzvat Yi'ud. He didn't do the mitzvah of Yi'ud, which means there's a certain purpose in all of this. By the way, this is even a better word than tachlis, you know, yi'ud. This is what the purpose of this was. So he says, Rashi's saying there's two levels of betrayal over here. One level of betrayal is that the father picked the wrong guy, and the other level of betrayal was the guy did not keep what was the proper purpose of this law, and that was to create some type of a relationship by marriage. And again, the other commentaries go more or less within the same directions, but it's interesting that Rashi did give us these two possibilities. And if you want to see the rest of the commentaries, you can. But it is fascinating that, and that's why I put the number 7 over here. It would have to be with Lotin Of, and I put it closer to this. This again, a betrayal normally within a marriage would be one of Bigida, of somebody cheating. But over here, it's considered to be a cheating. So therefore, and this is what I want to stress. You can now accuse me of being very imaginative by putting it here, but this is precisely what I wanted to get to. That when I see the Ten Commandments and I see extensions of the Ten Commandments, some of these extensions are going to be exactly what I just now said. Extensions. If it were obvious, then we wouldn't have needed the extensions. And over here, constantly in Mishpatim, again, I don't think there's any exceptions to this. Well, let me not say it like that. I think the challenge will be at first, does this fit in either easily or not so easily into something which is there? But once you understand that the Torah goes out of its way to label the lack of fulfillment of the yi'ud, of using this particular system, in order to create a marriage, then there's a begidah which took place. Then there is a betrayal which took place. I mean, some of the commentaries really do quite get straight strong in describing this level of betrayal. But also, it's fascinating what Rashi said. It's both the father's guilty and the prospective spouse was guilty. And again, you can now take this in other ways and exaggerate this a little bit more. You know, leading somebody on and then not fulfilling marriage and saying, listen, I'm not really serious enough to get married right now. That is a lower level of what's being described over here, that there is a purpose, there is a yi'ud, there is a relationship which is supposed to lead in a certain place. And yes, I'm willing to put this within the rubric of that particular commandment of the Sereta Dibrot, of Lo Tinaf. And again, I don't mind if you accuse me of exaggerating. I've been accused of far worse. Moving on a little bit more, and this gets, I think, a little bit easier. Maka ish vameit mot yumat. Now that, is the putting number six. Do you want to guess what number six is in the Sereta Dibrot now? Okay, so okay, Lo Tirtzach, that becomes very easy, because that's exactly what it says. The other thing which is interesting over here is Vasher Lo Tzadav HaElohim Inat Liado. Now that is something which is really important in a larger issue about what is taking place over here. But let me first read the next pasuk, and then I'm going to go back, because the Torah is doing something which is fascinating. Again, this is premeditated. You can drag the person away from the Mizbeach, from the Mishkan, from the Beit HaMikdash. You can't hide in a shul. By the way, the extension, you can't hide in a shul. You can't even hide if you built a shul, right? It's the same thing. If you donated a shul, you also can't hide. Basically, what this is telling us is that the man-to-man relationship, which, by the way, the Rambam stresses, the worst deviation from a man-to-man relation, or what we probably should call it, an interpersonal relationship, the worst deviation is murder. He says that is the worst sin in terms of interpersonal relationships. But I can now I get to this wonderful point about how do I balance between man to God and man to man. So God is saying, hold it a second. I don't care that the guy's in the middle of Shemona Esrei. He's a murderer, right? Now, there's a problem over here. I don't care that he's holding on to the Mizbeach. But there was something else there, which the Gemara will note and use and teach us something which is probably an incredibly important idea for us to understand, specifically in terms of Mishpatim. Because there may be a temptation on our part to really, again, to divide. God gave us a Ma'arechet HaMishpat. He gave us a legal system. Our legal system is, again, listen to the whole statement now before you get mad at me. When I finish, then you can get mad at me. The Jewish legal system is incredibly imperfect. If you want an indication of its imperfection, maybe the Gemara with Shimon ben Shetach could be used, that he sees a guy chasing somebody else, screaming, I'm going to murder you, I'm going to kill you, and he's got a knife in his hands, and he turns a corner, and then the guy's dead on the floor, he's holding the knife, it's dripping blood, and Shimon ben Shetach says, no, what can I do? There were no witnesses that saw it. But he knows what happened. It's very obvious what happened. It's almost impossible to say something else happened. I believe in American law, maybe even South African law, okay, Hungary. People like this will be charged with first-degree murder in such a case. In Jewish law, they're not charged with first-degree murder. Sorry, they'll get off. Now, that's why I'm saying it's imperfect. Well, how can we have a system that a person could get away with murder because we didn't have proper witnesses? So the answer, okay, that's, by the way, I hope you realize is a very big problem. What happens if one person sees it, two people don't see it? And by the way, there the halacha does deal with it a little bit better if there was one witness. But in terms of pure law, I'm not talking about extra legal solutions, but in terms of pure law, there is a problem. That's why I'm saying it's a very imperfect law. But obviously the law is working with a certain assumption. And that assumption is that there is a God who runs the universe, and God is telling us as people down here on earth, go do the best that you can. And I actually run the world, and I will make sure that people who deserve to be punished will be punished. Which, by the way, and just to deal with the issue of why bad things happen to good people and so on and so forth, God doesn't always deal with all those things over here in a way that we can discuss. discern, and the way that we could tell, sometimes it is Olam Haba, sometimes it's other kinds of punishments. But my point is that the mishpatim that we're being handed over here are a wonderful system, but they're also wonderfully imperfect. I just want to bring two Gemarot, one Mishnah, one Gemara, both in Makot, that will help us illustrate, I think, both of these points that I just now made. Is the wonderful Gemara in Source 20. Rav Shimon ben Lakish patachla pitcha lahai parshata mehacha. When he was teaching this parsha, I guess it's us, it's mishpatim. This is how he would teach it. V'asher lo tzadav elokim in ana liado, right? That's our pasuk. Kasher yomar mashal hakadmon mimishraim yatzirash and so on. B'meh katuv medaber b'shnei b'nei adam shergu at hanefesh. Dealing with two people who both killed someone. I'm using the word killed and not murdered deliberately here. Echad harag b'shogeg v'echad harag b'mezid. One killed by accident and one killed on purpose, premeditated. L'zeh ein edim, l'zeh ein edim. There's no witnesses, which means that justice cannot be served. HaKadosh Baruch Hu mazminan lepundak echad. God sends them both an invitation and tells them both to come to this particular inn. Zeh harag b'mezid yoshev tachad esulam. That person who killed deliberately, he's going to be walking underneath a ladder. Your right bin Sulam is coming down the ladder. Vinofa love a harigo, he falls down and he kills the person. Zesha harig b'mezid neharag, the person who was guilty of murder then will get his punishment. Vizesharag b'shoge gola, and the one who killed by accident, now there'll be witnesses and he'll have to go off into galut. Now, I'm not going to tell you that Reish Lakish is claiming that every single time that every single person does anything which is wrong, God micromanages and gives them their punishment in such a way. But Reish Lakish is saying, if you want to learn Parshat Mishpatim and not be troubled, realize that God has the ability and the capability to make decisions at which point he's going to micromanage and move in and solve these problems, which means we do have a legal system whereby we cannot solve every single problem, but we know that God is the backup plan, which means, maybe I'll put it a little differently, we have a legal system which, actually, I will put it differently, but only after I read the next Gemara, which is actually a Mishnah. So let's, and it's very famous. I mean, you should have known both of these sources before I read them. The other one is the Mishnah in Source 19. Sanhedrin areged echad b'shavua nikud chavlanit. If a Sanhedrin kills somebody even once in 7 years, it's considered to be a murderous, destructive court. Rabbi Lezman Azaria omer echad l'shivim shana. Even a kill once in 70 years. Rabbi Tarf and Rabbi Kiva omrim ilu hayinu b'Sanhedrin. If we would have been in a Sanhedrin during the time that they had capital punishment, lo nerag adam ba'olam. No one ever would have been executed. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Afhein Marabim Shofchei Damim B'Yisrael, because they're also responsible for people being killed. Now, obviously, this Mishnah is really important for any discussion about capital punishment, whereby apparently Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon are against it, and Rabbi Gamliel is in favor of it. And it says, by not having any type of capital punishment, you're causing there to be a lack of fear, and you're causing there to be more problems. So any of you want to have this debate, you could just learn the Mishnah with all the commentaries and have the debate. That doesn't interest me. What interests me is how in the world does Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, how do they learn the Chumash? The Chumash says, if you do this particular thing, mot yumat. You do this thing, mot yumat. You do think this, mot yumat. So this really takes us to the difference between the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, which, by the way, there are other things in this parsha that you need to make this distinction as well, including the more famous Ayin Tachat Ayin. And by the way, here I will absolutely recommend that you read the essay that I wrote about this, which is in Echoes of Eden on Ayin Tachat Ayin, because I think it really is quite important, which explains this point that I'm making now. The Torah Shebichtav tells us that these people should be put to death. So how in the world does Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon have the chutzpah to say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yeah, I never would have followed the halacha once? How can they say that? I mean, what gives them the right to make such a statement? Now, if you really understand what they're saying, they're saying like this. We know that God is in the background. We know that ultimately God is going to fix whatever needs to be fixed. What they're saying is, and I think there's a couple of points. One is, we would rather have a legal system that 999 guilty people go free, and now a Kaddish Baruch is going to have to deal with them because it's his problem, rather than run the risk of one innocent person be killed. If we're going to make a mistake, we do not want to make a mistake in that way. And therefore, if there's even the slightest thing that we, you know, can be down the kaf schut, we're going to be down the kaf schut. We're going to cross-examine the witnesses. We're going to ask them all kinds of questions. We're going to break them down until the point that we're not comfortable. If we're not comfortable, what can we do? We have to, you know, declare that the person is not guilty. So therefore, when I go back again and I ask the question, okay, so what is the Torah Shebichtav teaching according to them? The Torah Shebichtav teaches you values. Makat ish, right? Mot yumat. If you killed a person, you deserve to die. That doesn't mean I have to do this. This is a Kodesh Baruch Hu's world. Go ahead, take care of it. I'm not convinced. Even Shem Ben Shetach, I can't do anything in this case. But no, Kodesh Baruch Hu could do something in this case. Which means that I think that we've learned something else which is really interesting over here in terms of Parshat Mishpatim, that we do have laws over here, and the laws teach us values. And that's what we have to keep on looking for. What are the values being expressed over here? Maybe part of the value is something that I skimmed over in terms of the very first law of somebody, you know, who says, no, I want to be a slave. What do you mean you want to be a slave? I took you out of slavery. What do you mean you want to be a slave? You've misunderstood something really important. No, I want to remain a slave. So that there's a problem there in terms of values. In terms of values, taking this girl, putting her in an uncomfortable situation, should lead towards marriage. If it doesn't lead towards marriage, there's a serious problem over here. Who put this girl in this uncomfortable situation? This person committed a crime that is punishable by death. Okay, but we need to be convinced that it actually happened. Otherwise, this is a Kaddish Baruch Hu's problem again. And I'm saying that is wonderful. You know, when you put that, you know, they're both in Makot there. There's that mission. He put it together with Reish Lakish saying, you know, listen, Kodesh Baruch Hu runs the world. Kodesh Baruch Hu will figure out how to both, as I said, he'll send the both invitations. Please come to this particular inn, and I'm going to make an introduction between the two of you. Right? It's going to be a fascinating meeting between the two. But what we're really getting out of this is, yes, we have a Torah Shebichtav. See, it's interesting. If you want to get into, a very strong Christian attack that existed against Judaism, in terms of the Old Testament full of vengeance and anger and punishment and blood and so on and so forth, it's fascinating because most of their read of the quote-unquote Old Testament was the Old Testament without Torah Shebaal Peh. That once you consider the Torah Shebaal Peh aspect of it, then just a lot of their claims completely disappeared. And therefore they try to make this dichotomy, which is not a true dichotomy, is that Christianity is full of love and compassion, understanding, and so on, but Judaism is full of vengeance and hatred and anger and so on. Yes, the Chumash is, in terms of value system, of what a particular person deserves if they did something, including Ayin Tachat Ayin. If I knocked out someone else's eye, I deserve to lose my eye. That doesn't mean that a Beitin would ever do it. A Beitin can't do it. Then why is it written that way? It's written that way because that's what you deserve. And Torah Shebichtav tells you what you deserve. What does Torah Shebaal Peh do? Torah Shebaal Peh, okay, there's different ways of dealing with issues over you. We're not going to knock out your eye in money. But how could they say such a thing? The Chumash said this. No, we have a Masorah, Halacha Moshe Mesinai. It's not what it means. Then why write it that way? Write it that way because that's what you deserve. Any more about this, you have to read the essay. We'll leave it at that. But there's too many other mitzvot that I want to... that I want to come back to, I want to get to. So, how far did we get? Right. It's really interesting then to look at the next three, because you would have argued the sequence. Makat aviv v'imo mot yumat. So that's also fairly simple to find one of your Ten Commandments over there, although you actually found two of them, because you're dealing with makat, you're dealing with something which is closer to the makat over there, in terms of hitting, but maybe even a stronger connotation. Makat ish v'met mot yumat, u'makat aviv v'imo mot yumat. And then v'gonev ish u'mochro. This speaks about kidnapping. So if you're ever wondering, hold it, why did the Masorah tell us in the Sereta Dibrot that Gneva, that it's talking about there, is kidnapping? So first of all, the Gemara had a Masorah. The Masorah was that all of the Ten Commandments are punishable by death. So therefore, regular stealing is not punishable by death. So which Gneva is it? It's talking about kidnapping. So that's at least one approach which the Gemara has. But it's interesting, but that's really what it says in Parashat Mishpatim. So over here, if Mishpatim is coming to explain the Aseret HaDibrot, then it's wonderful because it just now revealed to us what exactly is what I would call the primary example of Gneva. It's not necessarily the only example, but it's the worst example of Gneva. The worst example of Gneva is kidnapping or stealing a person. But so what's interesting also is that Avivi Imo is over here in Pasuk Ted Vav, and then it's again in Yud Zayin, Umikalel Avivi Imo Mot Yumach, which can also possibly be more than one commandment, because it could also be depending on how you cursed. If you makalel with the Shem Hashem, then you actually also could have gotten up to two of the commandments. So that's also interesting, because whenever you have combinations of them, it makes it more interesting as well, because that became a much, I'll say again, a fascinating shir klali. Okay, what if you did this one, but you also did this avera? Look how the two of them come together. So that, in a sense, is really what's taking place over here. Moving on, we also have in Pasuk Yud Chet, we have again people that are beating, and one example is that if they, you know, what happens if they don't die? Now you have to take responsibilities. Right afterwards, we have again a beating, which will lead to death. But what happens over here now is going to be monetary responsibilities, again, including Shufto, you have to pay for his loss of wages. I mean, I just assume that that really was a radical concept at the time to understand. No, you have to pay, not just you have to pay damages, you have to pay for the loss of wages, for a poor year of pay, and you have to make sure that you make this person healthy again. The Ramban, by the way, is very interesting because he understands that the fundamental idea behind your pay, that's a permission. That there is this approach in the already in the Gemara or Braita or Yishmael, but he understands that Rapoyer Pay is actually comes from a monetary place, namely from returning a lost object. Oh, you took away his health, return the health that you took away from them. And that's how he understands fundamentally this particular law. We'll skip a little bit over here. Again, we get to the Ayin Tachet Ayin and so on and so forth, which is interesting, that you're a person who is violent and a person who's hitting, which means which numbers do I put this under? Do I put this under a lower level of killing somebody? Is there such a thing as lower level killing somebody? And by the way, I think it is. I think that's actually what is going on over here, and that all of the violence which is taking place is, if I have to put a category, where does this go? Do I put it under lo tachmo? Do I put it under lo tigmo? Do I put it under lo tiritzach? But what I can tell you is that I don't know it precisely that it fits in perfectly into any of the Sereta Dibrot, but nonetheless, it's a lower level of one of the Dibrot, which means beating somebody and they're not dying is a lower level of murdering somebody. And you could tell me that I'm exaggerating now. So again, I'll always plead guilty to exaggerating. What else is interesting is, again, having an eved, and you hurt his eye, you hurt his ear, so you hurt his teeth, the person gets to go free. Why? Because, okay, again, this idea of having a servant, having a slave, is not something which such a simple relationship, and you have responsibility. You must treat this person with dignity, which I think also is going to be something which is radical and is important, and it's saying that these are not an absolute relationship in the sense that you own this person, you could do whatever you want. No, this person is B'Tselem Elohim, and we're going to come back to the Tselem Elohim soon. This person is B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, and you have a responsibility to them. What follows is going to be, again, all kinds of laws of damages. And I'm just going to end off this chapter by saying as follows. If we knew every single Mishnah and every single sugi in the Gemara that flowed or emerged out of the verses that we just now read, we would know most of Nezikin. Because this is really the starting point of all kinds of things of Nezikin. And what's, again, is interesting about this, these are the Mishpatim, but what's the starting point? And I'll say it again. It seems to me that the way it's presented, that the starting point for all of this is the Sereta Dibrot. So the Ten Commandments. Now, all you can say to me, well, which one? And I'll say, so pick whichever one you want, because I think that sometimes there is a combination. I think, for example, the law against stealing is a very, very broad law. Again, you damage someone's cow, you damage somebody's thing, you weren't a good shomer, as it were. You didn't guard something properly, and so on. All of this comes out of the Lotignov, but someone's going to be tempted to say to me, but you just now said before that Lotignov is talking about kidnapping. And I'll say, yes, that is the highest level of kidnapping. And that's maybe even that's the pshat of what that pasuk means. nonetheless start thinking in multiple levels, because that's exactly what's taking place over here. The Aseret HaDibrot are both specific laws and also multiple layers and levels and expressions of divine wisdom, divine truth, and of laws, which means these laws that we have here in Mishpatim do fit into these 10 categories. And as we notice which categories, or as we attempt to figure out which categories, we're going to end up realizing things are much more, I'm going to say it again, complicated and nuanced than we imagined before. But yes, the primary example of Tignov was an example of kidnapping. That does not mean that all these other examples are not. They also are part of Lo Tignov, but on a different type of a level. Let's move on, because, as I said, there are so many examples that I wanted to get to. And you'll notice, Ki Yagnov Ish, so right, again, all kinds of other examples are stealing over here, and all of this, I do believe this whole section has to do with an extension of Lo Tignov. Okay, notice source number two. It's a source we should know. Rav Soloveitchik once made a very big deal about this pasuk. I'll explain. Shafech dam adam, a person who spills blood, ba'adam, damo yishafech. If you spill blood, your blood should be spilled. Again, that's a value. Why? Now, this didn't have to be stated. That should have been enough. Shafech dam adam, ba'adam, damo yishafech. Nonetheless, the Torah adds an additional statement. Why? Ki b'tzelem l'kimasat adam. So it's as if to say, why can't I commit murder? I can't commit murder because people are B'Tselem Elokim. What exactly that means then will become a much more interesting question. What does it mean that I can't kill somebody because they're B'Tselem Elokim? Do I extinguish, as it were? Notice I did say Kevayachal, as it were. Did I extinguish something divine when I kill a human being? Well, I certainly have hurt something who is B'Tselem Elokim. But what I want you to notice about that pasuk is the key. Meaning, don't murder, key. Don't murder, because. Now, keep that in mind, and I think we're going to see something interesting. Right afterwards, okay, again, this was in Bereshit. Now, we go to Perek Kaf Bet, the next chapter. So notice, we're continuing ganav. We just had a ganav before. Ki gnov ishor. So now you have a ganav. Do you have somebody who's a thief? He breaks into a house, right? He sneaks in. Vuhuka umet, and he's hit and he's killed. Ein lo damim. This was not considered to be murder. Why? On the other hand, if he comes during daylight, right, then it's a completely different situation. Why? What happened over here? So first of all, I think we know a lot of the details here, but we still need to speak it out. Over here, the Torah just now told us something. The person who sneaks in, the way the Gemara understands it, if he snuck in the middle of the night, then he realizes there's somebody going to be home, and he realizes that there may be resistance, and therefore he's prepared to take a life in order to steal what he wants to steal. Therefore, ein lo damim. Therefore, he has forfeited his own life while he is on this particular mission. So that's very interesting. Are any of us willing to go so far as to say that he no longer has tzelem elokim at that moment? Again, I'm not sure if you want to go that far. But I can't kill somebody because they're B'Tselem Elokim. But I can kill this person, so does that mean they don't have B'Tselem Elokim? And by the way, what about them has caused them to arguably have lost their B'Tselem Elokim? The fact that they're prepared to kill somebody, because somebody who's ready to kill somebody who is a B'Tselem Elokim doesn't have B'Tselem Elokim. So now, again, if you think you understood what I just now said, then I think you did. If it sounded confusing, then I apologize. But I can't kill somebody. Why not? Because they're in the image of God. They've been tzelem elokim. I can kill this person. So then what happened? I can't kill somebody because they're tzelem elokim. So apparently this person forfeited the tzelem elokim. But what about them made them forfeit the tzelem elokim? And the answer is because they're prepared to kill somebody who's been tzelem elokim. Therefore, they forfeited their tzelem elokim. But again, what I'm so fascinated over here And this is what I really want you to focus on. It's not just the laws which are interesting over here in Mishpatim. Because again, Mishpatim had the potential of being incredibly boring. Because reading legal systems are boring. This is not boring. It's not boring because of the values which are emerging. If you read the laws carefully, you suddenly realize, wow, that is really an interesting concept. And again, I had to add the Tzelem and Lekim into it. But the reason why I think that that's so important is because this is not going to be an isolated case. Let's go a little bit further over here. We have more stealing, more Geneva, which is taking place over here. And we'll skip through, we'll go down to Pasuk Tet. We've moved over here to the Shvuat Hashem, where now we moved into taking, stealing, potentially doing damage, potentially causing damage to somebody, which again would fit into stealing, but now using a vow, using God's name into it. So now we got to throw in another one of the Aseret HaDibrot. You were looking for an extension of adultery, Kol Shochevim Beimah Mot Yumat, okay? You were not looking for an extension that went that far, but look at that. You wanted extension of idolatry for worshiping other gods, Zobeach Elohim, Yechoram Bilti Lashem Levado. You cannot worship other gods, and that's there. Now, as we move to now Pasukav, you'll hopefully will realize why I went back to that Pasuk, Ki Betzelo and Ki Masat Adam. Again, just look at the formula of that. Shofech dam adam ba adam damoy shofech. If a person spills the blood of another person, keep it, right? They should be killed. Why? Keep it selim kimat adam. Which means it gave us not just a law, it gave us what perhaps sounded like an unnecessary, what we can call ta'amei mitzvah, or tama mitzvah, ta'amei mitzvot. It gave us a rationale for the mitzvah. Now let's look at Pasuk Kaf. V'ger lo tanav lo tilachsenu, do not abuse a convert, or do not put pressure on him. And now, key, Gerim Ayitim Beretz Yisrael. Now this formula of the key, this is not isolated. Look at the next pasuk. Kol amonav yatom lo ta'anan. Again, don't abuse the widows, orphans. Imanet ha'ne oto. Ki im tza'ok. Because if they scream, yitzok elai. Shemei shma tzakato. Because I'm going to hear what they have to say. So this is interesting because again, it doesn't just give us laws. It gave us laws and an explanation, but it also did something else. If they scream, key, over here again, if or when they scream, they're going to scream to me. By the way, notice, you were slaves in Egypt, do not treat the stranger in a terrible way, right? Don't treat the disenfranchised in a terrible way. You were disenfranchised. This idea, ki im tzaok yitzak, the Jews screamed out to God, right? At some point during the slavery, God says, I heard their screams. So God says, I'm going to hear their screams. Because when people scream, they're going to scream to me. V'chara'api, v'rakti etchem b'charev. V'yunashem la'almanot, uvenechem yitomim. And look what just now happened. I worked so hard before to find the Gemara in Reish Lakish and saying, look what happens. God is going to get involved. And don't worry, God's going to invite them both to the same inn. And over here, the Pasuk says it. It's God says, if you do certain types of abuse, I am going to get involved. Notice again right afterwards, in Kesef Talveh, if you lend somebody something, you took something as a collateral, im chabol techabel, right, salmat re'echa, if you have their cloak, the thing they need it at night, they need their blanket, they need to lie down. Ki, again, the ki, hi ksuto levada, hi simlato le'oro, b'me yishkav, v'ya ki yitzak, elai, v'shamati ki chonon ani. And if they scream, they scream to me, and God says, and you have to hear this because it's a powerful statement, because I am compassionate. And God is saying, if you're not compassionate, but I am compassionate. And again, I want you to pause over here, because I think something really dramatic just now took place as you're reading these verses. It didn't just tell us law. It taught us theology. It didn't just tell us law in a cold way, yes, no, this you can do, this is your responsibilities. It went much further than that. It gave us reasons, and it gave us compelling reasons, and it gave us scary reasons. It gave us compelling reasons, you were disenfranchised. It gave us scary reasons. If you mistreat others who have no one to protect them, God says, I am going to have, I have their back. Again, God has the prerogative. This is his universe. God has the prerogative to get involved and to micromanage anytime that he wants. And that's what I keep coming back to. That is the fascinating part of Parshat Mishpatim. And that's why we don't have to overextend our responsibility and make sure, oh, this person committed murder, but we don't, okay, let's fix the evidence. I once had dinner with Alan Dershowitz. And he told me that the day before, he had him and a bunch of people had met with Netanyahu. And everyone else left the room, and he was about to leave, and Netanyahu said, you know, Professor Dershowitz, can I ask you something? I said, sure. So we came back in. So he said, no, was OJ guilty? So he answered, and he said, once the police, what was the exact word, compromised the evidence, he could not be found guilty. But guilt or innocence in a court of law are legal terms. They're not historical terms, which means historically, it could very well be he killed him. Okay, I'm not even going there. But his point was, is that once the police played with the evidence, played with the glove, whatever it was that they did, they planted it. Once they did something wrong, because they wanted to, because they knew that he's guilty. They know that he's guilty. You have to, okay, but now we need the evidence. No, we can't do that. We can't do that. The procedure makes a difference. God gave us laws and says, you know, you have to be sure about this. But if you're not sure, don't worry. I'm in the background over here. And I'm in the background watching. I'm in the background to be involved in the background. I can do all kinds of things. And therefore, when you see that Reish Lakish read this into the Gemara before, that, oh, you know, I'll invite them. I'll take care of them. I'll take care of everybody. But now you realize God actually says, I'm involved and I will take care of things and I'm going to make sure that things are the way they should be. Again, I'm not going to claim to you that in this world, in a manifest way, that every single thing that happens is obvious and clear to us and we see God's fingerprints on every single thing. I'm not going to say that. I didn't say that. But what I will say is that at the end of the day, God is giving us the Torah and saying, now you go about, do your best. And in a certain sense, there's a partnership over here. That, by the way, I think is going to explain another phenomenon, which is really fascinating. And that is the use of the word Elohim, which means when it's talking about judges, the word Elohim as judge is being used. And I'm sure for a lot of people, the first time you ever saw it, it was jarring. What do you mean Elohim is a judge? I mean, it's a term for God. How can you be for judge? And I think there's very many levels of understanding this. On the one, you know, we are working for God when God is subcontracting us. But when you're a subcontractor, you're not the contractor. You're the subcontractor. You do what you can do, and you do a good job what you can do. And if there's something that you can't do, you go back to the contractor and say, listen, this is what my expertise is. I can't do this other thing. And I'm giving you back the responsibility. And even the use of the word Elohim in this sense by the judges, I think is really, again, on a theological level, is something which is fascinating. And again, if you just let your eyes sort of scan, I skipped over this back over here in Pasuk Dalet, or in that section, Pasuk Vav, you see, right, Im lo yimtza haganav, v'kred bal habayit ela Elohim. And then again in the next Pasuk, Ad Elohim yavod var shneim, asher shun Elohim yishalim shneim l'reihu. So it's just so interesting that that is the word which is used. And back here where more or less we were up to in the Kaf Zayin, Elohim lo tikalel. Which again, pretty, the way it's accepted is that it is talking about, this would again be the judges. It would be what it's talking about. Now there is a shift over here. And that is Pasuk Lamed. Ba'anshe kodesh tiyuli. Uvasar b'sadeh treifa lo tachlu lekelev tishlechunoto. So where did that come from? So the various parts of it, there was, as far as I can tell, in the Ten Commandments, no reference at all that even I can stretch to have some kind of implication in terms of kosher food. That's a little bit too far. But Anshei Kodesh is interesting. If you go back, source number 4, Perek Yutet, right before the Aseret HaDibrot, Vatem Tiyuli Mamelechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, that you are supposed to be a people that are holy for me. Of course, we did not know what holiness means. Rashi, The Rashi, which is more famous, is in Kedoshim, when he says, Kedoshim to you, Purushim to you, Vanshe Kodesh to you, Li, Imatem Kedoshim, Upurushim Mishikutse Nevelut Vetrefot Areatem Shali. To stay away from things which are non-kosher, because this is a question of holiness, which means it's interesting. I know that a lot of people try to tell you, eating non-kosher food is not good for you, it's not healthy for you, and so on and so forth. It's just not, I'm sorry to say that, it's just not true. Not only is it not true, I think it's theologically troubling to say that. It's not that it's not good for you. It's not good for your soul. It's not that it's not good for your body. It may be great for your body. It may be healthy. It may be good. You'll grow strong and so on. Eat lard for breakfast. I don't know. It's wonderful for you. May not be, by the way. But it's wonderful for you. I don't know. Scrambled eggs and lard. I don't know. It could be great. I know. But that's not the issue. That's not what it said over here. So the reason we can't eat it is because we're holy. Holiness doesn't have to do with the body per se, it has to do with the soul. And that's really what it's saying over here. So it's interesting that that was not part of the Aseret HaDibrot. I admit that. But that was the introduction to the Aseret HaDibrot. And that's what we need to notice. The other thing about the Kelev is also interesting, because the Kelev, at least, you know, Rashi tells us, based on Chazal, this takes us back to Yetziat Mitzrayim. Because even the Kelev has to be rewarded for what it did. And what it did is it didn't do anything. It kept quiet. A dog that doesn't bark should be rewarded, right? I have many dogs that I want to tell this to. But a dog that doesn't bark should be rewarded. But that's also interesting, is that, the way that Rashi says it, again, we could take a look at the Rashi. And I'm going to say it again. I am so much more interested now in the theology than I am in the particular law. L'kelev tishlechu noto, imkein, why the dog? Not only does God micromanage and he will make sure that the people that are guilty will be punished and the people that are good rewarded, even the dogs are rewarded for being quiet. Give him his reward. Which means, again, these laws are not just do and don't do's, do and don't do's. The theology over here is what I think is really remarkable. Let's see how many more cases we can get to. We get to source number 6. The reason we got a new number over here is because we got to a new chapter, Perikav Gimel. And you look up over there, and I have a whole bunch of numbers, 3, 9, 8. You could decide how many you want. Lotish Mashem Ashav, Al Tashit Yadchem Rasha, Liot Eid Hamas. So you have God's name in vain. You have, in terms of a court system, creating bad score. And by the way, to corrupt a court is not just against the Aseret HaDibrot, it's also against the Shev Mitzvah B'nei Noach. Lo tiachrei rabim l'ra'a, v'lo tana al riv l'natot achrei rabim l'atot, v'dal lo tehadar b'rivo. Don't reward somebody just because they're weaker, which means there needs to be justice there as well. This, by the way, is an incredibly important statement today in law today. It's that social justice still should be justice. You cannot ignore justice. I can't say that simply because of a person's socioeconomic situation, I am going to give them the benefit of the doubt in a legal case. I can't do that. I need to let the facts follow lead me to the conclusion, and I'll say it again. Hopefully, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to micromanage and get involved in cases and take care of the weak and take care of people who are disenfranchised and make sure that they become stronger. Which means that was exactly what was said to us before, but I cannot corrupt justice to do that. So I want to say this again. There's a whole section of verses over here. I cannot corrupt a just system. A legal system needs to be perfect. And if I can't do that, then I am corrupting something. And that's part of what comes out of the, again, this whole section over here. Lo tatem mishpat evyono birivo. Midvar sheker tirchak. V'nakiv etzadik al tarog. Ki lo atzdik rasha. V'shoched lo tikach. Ki ha-shoched yaver pichim v'yaslev divrei tzadikim. You can't take a bribe, even if you're going to rule that way. No, you can't take it, because that blinds people. You need to stay away from things which are false. And by the way, some things that people don't always recognize is that, and I think this is true in terms of halacha, and if you wish, machshava, and that is the idea that you cannot lie. It never said you can't lie. It says that you need to stay away from something which is false. this is in the context of a court system. Lo tatem mishpat evyoncha birivo bidvashek atirchak. And then right afterwards, don't take a shochad. This whole section is understood. This is a brayta which says this, that the whole section is about a court system. You cannot corrupt a court system. Finally, we have another, you know, one that rings the way. And again, if this, you didn't note it, shochad luktach ki hashochad yaver. Again, the pasuk before, v'tzadik al tarog ki lo atzdik rasha. It is these constant explanations of the laws which are so interesting along the way, or God's comments along the way, not just laws, laws with comments, and that's what's fascinating and needs to be analyzed in this parsha. How much more time do we have? Not very much. We then move towards Shemitah. We move towards holidays. We move to, again, moving towards the Shabbat, Zechor Yom Shabbat L'Kadsho, with extensions. Extensions are Shalosh Regalim Techog V'Shana, right? Pesach, Shavuot, and so on. All of these come up right afterwards. And finally, there is even a reference at this point. Any of you who think that the Beit HaMikdash or the Mishkan is only mentioned after the Chet HaEgel, look how they snuck this in over here in Pasuk Yutet. Reishit B'Kriyad Matcha Tavi Beit HaShem Elokecha. Right? Make sure that you're going to bring the Bikurim when you come to Eretz Yisrael to Beit HaShem Elokecha. It's, by the way, it's not the first reference. There are others as well, but sometimes people do get a little bit confused. The last section, which we're not really going to get to all that well over here, is something which is a little different, but it moves over to Eretz Yisrael. And it moves to how can we can hold on to this land, which is sort of like the holiness thing that I mentioned before. But part of what's going on now also is most of the laws that we've discussed till now were laws which were micro laws having to do with individuals. And at some point, we're going to move to laws that have to do on a much broader point. And the broader point is the land of Israel and a collective. And at some point along the way here, we do move to this collective. And that's what's going to happen again, as we move further to the last section over here, which is the collective of the Jewish people. So I don't know how successfully I explained what I was trying to explain today, because it wasn't simple, and we were reading verses constantly. But what I want you to see, it's not just law. That's the first point. It's not just law. It's law and theology together. And we need to understand how they interact, because that's where it gets interesting. And there's a lot of theology over here to unpack and to understand. The formula, which I think hopefully you'll be more sensitive to every time you have a key over here, you know, there's an explanation, there's something more. Every single time that was there, that's where you had to pause and say, okay, that was the law, now I need to think about it, to contemplate it. What is this telling me? What is this teaching me? What am I able to distill of this? The other thing about this is that God is constantly involved in all kinds of ways. And that's why Reish Lakish's sensibility over here, oh no, God is here. God is involved in this. And now we understand Rabbi Akiva as well. Yeah, God is involved in this. I don't have to go and kill somebody if I don't. I never would have killed anybody because I'm going to leave the dirty bit. Let God do it. Yes, God is going to let us be the subcontractors, and we're going to do our best. But when it comes to actually pulling the trigger, no, Kodesh Baruch Hu, you're mechubad, right? We'll give you the first. You get to do this. We'll do our best to make a legal system and make it work. But when it really comes down to the really bad things, yeah, we understand that we're just shlichim from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we'll let you handle these things. And that's also what's interesting is how much God is here within things which you could have thought are only, I'm sorry for saying only, interpersonal between people. They're torts, right? They don't have that much to do. No, God is constantly in this, and there is something that there was a tension. We need to absolutely take care of the disenfranchised. We need to have compassion. We need to lift them up. We need even, you know, in every way. And if it's from the beginning, to marry that poor girl and bring her into a wealthy family and creating some kind of social justice, or taking care of that widow and their orphan and creating social justice, or that person who there was a collateral but they need their blanket at night, that's social justice. But to corrupt a legal system and therefore to say, listen, the person's poor, therefore I'm going to change the judgment around, no, you can't do that, because when you're a judge, you're acting like God. God is subcontracting to you and telling you, please, you know, be my shaliach over here, and it has to be truth. It has to be dealt with truth. Compassion on the one hand and truth on the other hand. Okay, that's challenging. That's what our mandate is. And then I'll say it again. If you thought that Parashat Mishpatim was really, really boring, I hope at least I convinced you that it's not as boring as maybe you thought it was.